Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. Oh dear, we're talking healthcare tonight, folks, which means I have to do the, anybody who listens to the show for any length of time knows what's probably coming next, but I have to get it out of the way because we are talking about healthcare. We are talking about Alberta Health Services. We're talking about the state of healthcare in the province of Alberta. And I have a little bit of a bias on that one because, as anybody who's listened to the show for any length of time knows, I work professionally as a paramedic in the province of Alberta. So, to be clear, for my bosses, I assume, who are listening to this, any views that I share on this episode of The Breakdown are solely the views of myself and do not represent any organization to which I may or may not be affiliated. All of that being said, we got some big topics that we're going to be getting into tonight, and we've got something of an authority on these topics who's going to be sharing a little bit of perspective. I am extraordinarily excited and grateful to welcome to the show none other than the president of the Alberta Medical Association, Dr. Paul Parks. Dr. Parks, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thanks tons for having me here.
Now, before we get into the lighter fare of the conversations that we're going to have, it's going to be a light conversation tonight.
Healthcare is really light, right?
You know, there's nothing going on. before we get into all of that, I'm going to ask you to do the same thing that I ask all of the guests on our show to do, and that is just to introduce yourself to the audience. So who is Dr. Paul Parks? And I'm going to throw a secondary question right in there because I have a feeling it might be tied to the first part of the question. What got you into medicine?
Oh, good questions. Okay, well, so of course I'm Paul Parks, and so I'm an eMERGS physician, and I've been practicing in Alberta, including my training here, since 2000, actually. So did my training in U of A up in Edmonton, worked there for a long time, and then moved my family, been down in the Hat, Medicine Hat, since 2009. So I've worked in the big urban centers and the big tertiary centers, and now down in the regional centers, got a good flavor for emergency medicine and healthcare across Alberta for 24 odd years now. So obviously I'm the president of the Alberta Medical Association as well. So I am speaking on behalf of an organization. I'll try to make it clear if some of this is my own personal opinions, but mostly trying to represent the profession and the whole and what's been going on in Alberta from the lens of physicians and the Alberta Medical Association. And then what got me into medicine? Well, I mean, obviously he had an interest in medicine and the science of biosciences and sciences, but it kind of sounds a bit trite, but part of the calling was to try to, you know, impact people, make a impact on people's lives and help people out. And that's actually one of the things that drew me to eMERGS right away is a couple pieces. One, of course, the variety and just being able to see a whole bunch, and it's always different. That is really draw for me. But the other is, we really, throughout my training and throughout a lot of my life, you know, that exposure to be the marginalized patient populations, the people that are at risk in society, the fact of that healthcare helps those people, of course, but then eMERGS is even the safety net for that. So, I think most people that are in medicine, a big draw of it is that they want to try to help people and have an impact on their fellow Albertans and Canadians. And that for sure was a draw for me. And then, like I said, eMERGS, really we'll probably talk on some of these topics, but really those patient populations that are, you know, in difficult situations because they weren't planning to get sick and weren't planning on traumas, things like that. But obviously also like homelessness, opioid crisis that we're facing across the province, a whole bunch of issues that really disproportionately affect different patient populations. My hope is to make a difference there.
Now, I'm going to ask the question this way as a bit of a pivot. You just listed off a bunch of things that you practice as an emergency room physician. When you started in emergency medicine, did you anticipate that you, like many other emergency physicians, were told would also be in a position where you'd potentially be practicing family medicine in the emergency room?
No, I mean, I don't think many of us in that. You know, coming out of the 90s and in early 2000s, eMERGS medicine was kind of becoming its own specialty in many, many ways. And It was, I mean, I don't have to remind people some of the ER and the TV show and all that exciting stuff, but I should be honest, right from the get-go, Emerge isn't always that, like, everything, life and death and everything exciting. And yeah, you'd see lots of a variety of different types of conditions, and you would see, the odd family medicine related type care that you would, just they wouldn't have that access or it was convenient. You'd see that for sure throughout my training, but early on, no, like, honestly, over the 24 years, that evolution over time around access block to getting into primary care, a lot of the systemic issues around access to preventative care and just access to what people would know as a family physician and a general practitioner has really devolved over time to the point where, none of us, I, in the last couple of years, in most of the emergency departments in Alberta, we'll be seeing 20 to 30% of our patients don't have a family physician. And it's actually crazy to think about that in many times we're dealing with things like, essential hypertension, so blood pressure control, and having to see things that really need continuity care and need repeat visits. We're seeing that and dealing with that on a daily basis in Emerge. And I should definitely say this gets confused a little bit, but this isn't to blame those patients. Like, it's not like, oh, this is inappropriate use of the Emerge. What the heck are they doing there? And some of that dialogue and thinking that comes out. Because in reality, most of these people we're seeing now that there is no other option. There's nothing else they can do. There's nowhere else they can go. And in fact, to tie to that corollary, I can't imagine now, 24 years later, and speaking to my colleagues, the advanced disease we're seeing now, like it really advanced cancers, advanced heart disease, a whole bunch of really, chronic conditions that have really been delayed in diagnosis and or really progressed because of no access to family medicine. So no, long answer. The short summary is I can't believe the state it's in right now in terms of access to family medicine for sure.
I want to take a sec to just sort of hover on a point that you made there before I get to the big question that I was trying to pivot to. And that's, we have seen some rhetoric from, let's go with some people who may or may not be elected officials, in regards to the blaming of patients. Well, if they had only done X, if they had only done Y, then they wouldn't have gotten into this position. But I think it's really, really important to highlight what you just said there. Even when you're talking about those benign conditions, like things like hypertension or high blood pressure, if somebody doesn't have access to a family doctor to manage that sort of thing, that's the kind of thing that can turn into really big issues. And it is a good thing. I mean, given the circumstances, it's a good thing that these people are accessing care in the way they are. But for somebody who doesn't have the ability to recognize the signs and symptoms of the things that they're experiencing and go, oh, I really should do X, Y, Z, that's not a fault of their own. And I just really want to sort of take a sec to go, yeah, we should not be blaming patients.
Oh yeah, I mean 1,000%. I should say that there's always, as a physician, there's always a component of that anybody can make healthy choices and make, exercise and diet and certain things that are in control. No question that being a participant in your health care and in your health is everybody needs to do that, and that's just the baseline. That's a given. But what we're talking about in our system around, really advanced cancers coming in or bad heart attacks or strokes because their blood pressure was totally unmanaged. And these aren't things that y these are things you need. This is the whole point of something like family medicine. And the specialty is you need screening and you need preventative discussions and you need sometimes it's as simple as, blood pressure medicines or different things, cholesterol medicines. Nobody has a clue what their cholesterol is if you don't have screening and don't have treatment. And that's the whole point of preventative healthcare. And so, yeah, and the whole, I should just emphasize, like, clearly, like the whole idea around Emerge overcrowding and people having access in Emerge, it's quite a misnomer that it's the simple, easy stuff that's blocking up the Emerge, and it's the people that are coming in with stubbed toes and things like that. Honestly, most don't because it takes so long to get seen. But those little simple things are easy for us to see in the sideway in a hallway. Boom, in and out, you're out. We give some advice, and they're easy. A lot of the stuff we're talking about now, it's not things that are in the patient's control, and it's stuff that is really advanced and really needs skilled physicians and healthcare workers, and that's the whole point. We're there. When you've got chest pain, how do you know if that's indigestion or if it's your heart attack, right? That's what our jobs are. That's what we do. And so no, I just absolutely the stuff we're seeing in the emerges in the hospitals and the healthcare we're talking about, this isn't preventable. This isn't stuff that you could blame the patient. It's about how our healthcare system works for the patients.
Yeah, I just wanted to really sort of, given the depth and breadth of the conversation I hope we're going to have tonight, I just really wanted to emphasize that piece out of the gates because the implication, and I'm really grateful that you brought that point up, the implication that people are going to the ER for dumb stuff and it's causing huge backlogs in hospitals. Dumb stuff is actually pretty easy to clear out, so there's that. But the point that I was trying to get at before we had that nice little sidebar, which was incredibly important, is, we are seeing more and more emergency physicians who are finding themselves in the role of family practitioner, family medicine. There's been a lot of conversation in the media about we don't have enough doctors. And it's not just doctors in one specific specialty like emergency medicine. There's certainly some big issues in family practice that I'm hoping we're going to be able to talk about. But as a whole, Alberta has sort of been hemorrhaging, if you will, physicians for a while. And I was hoping that you might be able to shed some light on sort of the history. How did we get to a place where the province that has arguably the greatest resources at its disposal has this crisis of not having physicians?
Yeah, well, it's a million-dollar question. I'll tell you, there. I mean, this is you got to simplify it a little bit. I could probably talk for hours on the history of the, that kind of stages things went through. But in a nutshell, to be really blunt, the Alberta had the Alberta advantage in the two, in the 2000s into the 2010s. Like we were really the destination to come to. We were recruiting, some of the best healthcare workers in the world. Alberta really truly had the Alberta advantage. And then, there were some subtle changes through time that there was, things didn't keep up with inflation. Certain things were slowly not doing as well into the mid 2000s, and there was some access block overcrowding, some issues around capacity in our hospitals, and things that were starting to make it a little bit harder to recruit as well as we would have liked to. But we were still doing amazing, and we really were like cutting edge in research, cutting edge in it's the place to come. It was the place to be. In fact, I've been doing this a long time, and examples are residency training throughout the first 15, so 2000 to call it 2017, 18. This was the place. Every resident wanted to come work and do their training in Alberta and stay in Alberta. Speed forward, and I'll just be extremely blunt with Minister Shandro, the previous government. They went full out war on physicians. Like it sounds like hyperbole to say that, but I got to tell your listeners and Albertans, they just walked in one day, said, "Enough, we're tearing up your contract." Never been done in the history of Canada. We had a negotiated contract. They walked in and just tore it up, said it's done. And then they made some unilateral changes and cuts, just saying, "I'm the minister, I get to do what I want." They made some huge impacts to family medicine, which we'll probably talk about. Speed forward some of the cuts they made in family medicine that amounted to about a 20% pay cut. Boom, 20 to 30% right away unilaterally. And you got to understand too, there's a lot of talk, talking fully support our nurses, UNA, all of our allied healthcare workers. I mean, yourselves and EMS, everybody that's part of the team. They have a bit of a, you guys have a bit of a different process because you're part of unions and you have some collective bargaining rights and some specifics that are very different for physicians. We don't have that. And we can't strike, for example. We don't have the same rights to unionize. And there's pluses and minuses to why that exists. But when they tore up our contract, we were literally in this scenario in Alberta where they pretty much basically set a precedent saying, "Listen, we there's absolutely nothing you can do about your work environment nothing you can do about how you're compensated and or how you function on a day-to-day basis in your work. And that set a terrible precedent across Canada. There wasn't a single new grad, resident, or doctors looking anywhere that were thinking, "Hey, I want to go work in a province where the government is full out on war with the physicians and treating them in a way where they have no recourse, no nothing really." And then, all of a sudden, all that happens, and then we get a once in a lifetime, a once in a century pandemic. And we were literally as a profession just going to start to mobilize and do a lot of work to try to let the public know what the government had done to us, let everybody know how bad the situation in Alberta was, and then all of a sudden get hit the pandemic. And I'll tell you, kudos to my profession, to every allied healthcare worker out there. We just rolled up our sleeves and went to work. It was a tough time during COVID, and we decided, you know what, there's bigger things right now than to fight this government. So we actually did our jobs. We went and took care of patients, and all of us, like physicians, help every allied healthcare worker, paramedics, respiratory therapy, everybody in the system rolled up our sleeves and did it. And that took a toll, because then you have this environment where we couldn't recruit into because of the government changes, and we burnt out a bunch of our staff because of COVID and the pandemic and the work we're doing. And then you come to where we are now, where we have a new government that is, I mean, same party, but new leader, new, a lot of the party is new, and thankfully we're starting to repair that relationship. But I'll be honest with you, man, that breaking that trust and creating that adversarial of environment, we are still dealing with that today, right now in Alberta. So that's a nutshell of a big piece that really set us back to the point now where we honestly, we're not, it's not making it up to say we have an Alberta disadvantage right now to recruit into this province. And that's what we're trying to repair and try to, it takes a second to break that trust. It's going to take years and years to regain it.
I'm as you're talking there towards the end, I can't help but think of, I saw a survey not too long ago that talked about sort of the intentions of physicians across the province, and I don't think it would be hyperbolic in any way to say it was pretty dire. I mean, there are a lot of physicians who are saying that they didn't see being able to run their practice past 6 months. There were a stunning number of physicians who were saying that they were looking at retiring or leaving the province within 6 months. What are sort of the, if you can, I mean, Chandro, we make jokes about Chandro, like he was just the gift that came, they kept on giving on our show. But Chandro's gone, and there seems to have been some positive movement, he said cautiously, in regards to repairing some of the damage that Chandro and that iteration of that government did. Why are those numbers still so, oh, this is all very bad?
Yeah, I mean, a combo. So I should say kudos to the new minister that we do have a positive relationship, and it's not like the previous one. Obviously, Minister Copping came in and started to try to repair that a little bit. And then, now Minister LaGrange, we do have a much better relationship. But the part that is, so specifically, the numbers you're quoting around family medicine, for example, over 51% are going to either leave the province, retire, or stop doing comprehensive family medicine. That's not half of our family docs are in the next year if things don't change. That's it as an example. We're having the same. Unfortunately, we just had a CARMS match, is our residency matching, that we just had in Calgary, for example. For the first time ever, there are empty spots in general surgery. Nobody wants to do general surgery in Alberta. No, it's like even our specialists now are, the environment is so difficult. That again, we're repairing that relationship, but the damage done, that still lingers. But then add the burnout that happened through the pandemic and the fact that we never really replenished positions in that kind of 3 year period because no one was coming into the province, that kind of huge gap around our workforce. It's just put us so far behind. And then to go to specifically the numbers you're quoting around family medicine, for example, add to all of that environment, unilateral cuts that Minister Chandro did that were really 20 to 30% pay cut, just boom, you're that's gone. And then add, which we all know, the inflation and cost of living since the pandemic has kind of simmered down, and that inflation, if you think about these practices, anybody, one of the most baffling things to most people in Canada, Alberta, they don't really think about. If you come see me in the hospital, everything is paid for. The Band-Aids, the anything. If we give you a Tylenol, it's paid for. If you go to a community clinic, everything there, every single thing is paid for by the physician out of the billing that they do with their. So when you hear about numbers of family physicians are only averaging $340,000 a year billings, they've got to pay for multiple staff, their lease, their everything. And then if they give you or do anything while you're in their office, they pay for all the supplies and everything. That inflation, all those costs, they're paying more than two-thirds of their billings is going to just run their offices. And so we're just in this cycle of where we've lost a huge amount of our workforce. We haven't replenished them. And family medicine, as an example, has become totally non-viable with the funding model they have right now. So nobody wants to come into Alberta. And then the last end, which there's a lot of them, is BC, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, the Maritimes. They all realized the funding model for family medicine was broken, and they all fixed it. They all started to do different funding models and started to become really competitive and attractive to go to. And we have not done it yet. We've given the minister and the government a new funding model that'll help this, but we haven't implemented it yet. We haven't got there yet. So lots of factors going into it, but we do have an Alberta disadvantage right now. It's not hyperbole. We have to change that narrative. We have to break it.
So what's, I mean, there has been a lot of conversation around the funding model, the proposed funding model. There was some sort of wait, we'll give you a little bit of money while we figure out the funding model thing that happened. Can you, at a high level, walk us through a what was that interim funding that I think has happened now? There was a lot of like, maybe it didn't happen. No, it hasn't happened yet. Maybe it did happen. If you can walk us through that, and then if you could walk us through what is the funding model that you believe needs to be in place in order to address everything you just laid out.
Yeah, so specifically for family medicine, we said, went to the government and said, listen, in order to retain our physicians we have right now, we've got this, we're really at such a disadvantage because of the cost of running their business and because of the, in a way, the premier even stated this at one point, and Premier Smith said, listen, these family doctors are trying to run a $400, $350, $400,000 business at $36 a treatment, an encounter. That's pretty much all they get. I mean, in a day and age where a haircut can cost $50 to $100, it's crazy. We're paying our doctors in such, our family docs in such small increments. That's the fee for service model that they've been stuck in forever. It's a legacy of how they paid. The patient has to be right in front of the doc. It's one problem, one visit, one problem, because they get only $36 regardless of how much time they spend with you. That's the stuff that drives Albertans crazy. No one wants to go to the doc three times for three different things. It's a funding model that doesn't work. And so and it doesn't support their it no longer keeps up with inflation, doesn't do anything that will make it so they can actually keep their lights on. And so this new funding model, what a lot of provinces have done and what they've changed is really in a high level nutshell, there's two pieces we did. First, we said we have to stabilize and keep who we have right now. So that's the stabilization funding that just came out. That was the federal money. The government announced 100 million and 100 million. That literally is to go to family docs so they keep their offices open so they can still pay their staff, pay their leases. Every day now, I have family physicians in Alberta writing me as the president of the AMA saying, if things don't change, I'm not renewing my lease. I'm going to let go of my panel. I'm going to stop being a family physician. So we said, we got to stop that. We got to get them some money. So just actually on Tuesday, we started to give some of the stabilization money so that we can retain them. The second piece that's critical is this new funding model. And the new funding model is a move away from this fee for service, one patient, one thing, to, in a real big, broad nutshell, it's got a panel base. So if you have an X number of patients based on how complex they are, how old they are, you have some panel funding. You have some funding for the time you spend when you're checking labs at 10 o'clock at night and the patient's not in front of you and the work you're doing That's time-based. And then you have a volume modifier, which is that kind of the more patients you can bring in and see them and incentivize so people can get in to see their family physician. Those three components are a new way of funding family physicians that will make their practice viable. That's what we've given to the minister. April 1 on her desk. We worked on it as hard as we could in the last 3 months, took components from the best components from BC, from Manitoba, Saskatchewan, made it Alberta, added our own Alberta kind of pieces that we really think will help allow teams to be built around it. A lot of components that'll make primary care and family medicine and rural generalists much better and much more robust. And we're waiting to get that funding model implemented. We got to get the minister to say, yes, we're doing this. We're going to implement this. We're going to be competitive with the provinces around us with this new funding model that allow family physicians to keep their offices open, as an example. So that's a nutshell of what we've been working so hard in the last 4 months with the government around. And when I say we, it's mostly like family medicine leaders that have been at the table working with Alberta Health to create this new funding model that, like I said, it's done. It's on the minister's desks. We just got to implement it now.
I want to just sort of drill down a little bit deeper in a couple of things there. So I want to clarify because you used a little bit of vernacular there.
Oh yeah.
When we say panel, we're talking about like the roster of patients that a physician has. So if a physician is taking a family physician has agreed to care for 500 patients, then that rather than calling it a roster because it's not sports, those 500 patients are referred to as a panel.
Yeah, that's correct. And so the panels will vary based on, as an example, 500 is a good number because, some docs are only have it in a nutshell. Actually, probably even simpler is if you said Dr. X is my family doc and that's who I go to all the time. That's who's on their panel. And some may only have 500 because they also cover in the emerge and they cover if they work in a smaller spot, they cover in the hospital, take care of long-term care patients. Some have 1,000, some have 1,500. Those docs would probably more do just what people think of as just primary, like comprehensive primary care, not just as in that's their focus. They'll spend 4 or 5 days doing that. And so the panel sizes will really vary. But yeah, that's what people would think of as Dr. X is my doc, and Dr. X is saying, yeah, that's my patient. That's the number of patients I have that I take care of. And then we add a complexity modifier saying, because obviously having a healthy 18-year-old is very different than if you have a 70-year-old that has diabetes and stroke, and it takes more time for those more complex patients. So we don't treat every single patient as exactly the same, but that's what we mean by paneling.
Okay. And I just want to confirm the funding, the top up, the interim money, that was federal money, correct?
Yeah, so we call it stabilization money, but yeah, that's what we announced in. The minister and myself and the premier announced in the it was like 20th of December thereabouts was that was the federal $200 million that the federal money for healthcare top up for specifically for primary care. And again, I should say we're thankful and grateful for that because the government could have spent that on anything in healthcare related. And so we really advocated saying, really that the found why are we focusing on primary care? I mean, we can talk about what's happening in the hospitals too, because there's a big lots of issues and a crisis around in the acute care hospitals too. But in Alberta, the state of family medicine, which is the foundation, the preventative stuff we're talking about, and the foundation of healthcare, that had crumbled so bad that we're like, listen, this is mission critical. This is the first step we got to deal with. And so we convinced, discussing with the minister, and they agreed, the government, that 200 million should be dedicated to stabilizing our family medicine specialty. So we can keep who we have, and then we build this new funding model so we can recruit more people in,
So,
more physicians from across Alberta, more residents, more trainees, that kind of thing.
just so that I get it right, and I'm going to do something that I don't do very often, we have to give props to the federal government for giving the money to the province, and then we have to give props to the province of Alberta and the health minister for saying we're going to use this money to stabilize family medicine until we get this payment thing worked out. Am I?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think it's fair too, as well, to say, listen, like that's a perfect example of talking about the Chandro days and the difficulty there, they literally said to AMA, "Hey, we don't care. We don't care at all what you guys think and what your opinion is. We're just going to do our own thing." At least, like, now this government said, "No, actually, we get it. We can't run this healthcare system without the AMA and the experts and the frontline input." And so they listened to us. And a double kudos, I can tell you. You probably don't have to tell your listeners out there that the provincial government and the feds aren't the best of friends. So,
shocking news.
so it wasn't the easiest thing to speed up and get that funding to so we could try to get it out in an accelerated manner. So that did take some effort on our government's part to kind of work with the feds and push and kind of get that funding done in an accelerated manner. So it is a positive that we were able to do this and direct it to family medicine, where we all agreed that that's where the first big, huge crisis that we have to deal with exists.
All right. Well then, props to all of those folks. I want to get into a little bit more about how to fix the situation with physicians, not just in the because you made it clear the family medicine crisis is very much the biggest crisis. Before we get into that, do you have any idea, like, is there a timeline on this funding model? Like, if they said, we'll give you an answer by, I don't know, we're recording this on April 9th, maybe April 10th, or
No, not yet. In fact, one of another positive, we had the premier come to our representative forum at the end of March. It's the first time a premier's come to our AMA representative forum with the minister. And I was being a bit cheeky, pushing, saying, let's get this announced by April 15th, and kept putting a deadline there. So we don't have an official deadline, but I think that's most, taking joking aside or putting an arbitrary deadline, I think it's critical. And I can't stress this more, and I've been saying it as much as we can publicly. Like, if they just give the stabilization money and don't give us a model to transition to, it's we'll lose more family physicians, and we'll have no foundation to build on. They'll go work in other provinces. They'll go set up there. Once someone closes down an office and leaves, the odds of getting them back is so minuscule. So we need the minister and the government to announce this new funding model in the next, like, days, weeks at the most, kind of thing. So the one positive we got out of the premier is the minister did say it's going to take a lot of work and going to take some time, and at least the premier said publicly to all the physicians that this is going to take weeks and we're going to get it done quickly. And this was at the end of in the end of March. So we just got to keep pushing. We got to get this funding model out, because then if not, the way I'd put it is there's just no hope for a lot of the family physicians that are looking to carry on into the next year or two. They need a new funding model to see that it could be viable. So not a date yet, but I'm pushing and pushing as hard as we can to get them to announce it and commit.
well, just in case, Dan, I mean, like I said, we're recording this on the 9th. It'll go up on the 11th. If she announces it before then, good job, Premier Smith. And if she doesn't, TikTok.
There you go.
But moving on from there, what are the other things that need to happen to, I mean, we've talked about the family medicine piece. What are the other big things that we need to see happen in order to disabuse our province of the Alberta disadvantage when it comes to physicians and to regain that Alberta advantage?
Yeah, you know what? So I'm speaking on behalf of the AMA, of course. So I, you know, my lens is a bit more physician oriented, but I'll say, every allied healthcare worker, everybody in our workforce is beyond our critical challenge. Like, from nursing to paramedics to every single facet of our workforce is significantly depleted. It's never been like this. Like, everywhere you go, in the hospitals, on wards where there would normally be, eight nurses, they're routinely functioning with five or six, and having double the patient loads. Like, so in our acute care hospitals, the things we're seeing now where a ward, say, if a team of 10 nurses took care of 30 patients, now we have a team of, six nurses taking care of 45 patients. That kind of regular workload imbalance with workforce imbalance. And so again, when I use physicians, it's kind of just a slice of that whole pie of the workforce that we have to improve, because Right now we are at huge deficit. Like we are, looking at AHS's numbers provincially. One of the frustrations, to answer the question, kind of, getting back to it in a not roundabout way, is we need a good workforce plan. We need to actually look right now and say, hey, what's our snapshot? What do we really have for, healthcare workers? What kind of work are they doing? What's our, are we in a surplus or are we in a deficit? How many do we need? What's our plan to get to where we need? And one of the traps that the government keeps falling into and that we got to break around workforce planning, A, it's not being done provincially in a coordinated effort, even though we've talked about the importance of it. B, we'll probably talk a bit about restructuring of the healthcare system that's coming and hitting us. But AHS used to do a big component of this, but by breaking up AHS and the four different pillars, there's lots of components that AHS isn't even getting involved in now in the workforce planning. So somebody has to step in to do that. And then the third piece is we got to move away from just this headcount. What's happened more and more and more is if you just count how many physicians there are, yes, there's more than ever. But the best example I can give you is in emergency medicine. We are probably at about, like, if you count all of our emerge physicians across the province, we're probably only at about 75% of what we need to run our emerge departments across the province. In terms of, we called it a full-time equivalent FTE, we're only at about 75%. Anesthesia is probably across the province, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60% FTE. So we have tons of physicians, but they're often doing so, like in emerge, for example, I can work in emerge. I can do administrative stuff like I am with the EMA, but I can also do, stars and transport, EMS transport. I can do toxicology. I can do so many other roles that take me out of the working straight just shifts in the emerge. And right now we don't have a good picture. When you look at any specialty, any type of position in the workforce, we do not have a good understanding of what it looks like right now, what our actual current workforce is and what our deficit is, and that's what we got to break. We got to figure out what the heck the workforce is that we need, and then we really have to create an environment that's gonna, because we're gonna be competing, we already are, against a national shortage and a global shortage for healthcare workers, and so if we're not really strategic in how we recruit, we'll never fix it.
You kind of teed me up for my next topic, so I'm gonna take advantage of it. And it blows my mind that I can accurately use this word, but one of the things that we've seen the provincial government move forward is the quite literal disintegration of the integrated health service that was built being Alberta Health Services. It seems like there are two camps of thought on the disintegrated system or the integrated system. There's a lot, I've seen a lot of very smart people say no, but AHS was actually the integrated system removed barriers. It was the crown jewel of healthcare that many people around the world are trying to emulate. They're trying to pursue that because it did remove barriers to entry. It did remove barriers to care. And then there are people who are saying, no, we need to have a disintegrated system. And everything will be in its own silo and that will be better. I know what my personal take is, but I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the disintegration of healthcare in the province of Alberta?
Oh, I gotta say, disintegration's a terrible word. And
It's
honestly, I know, weirdly enough, I think I haven't, so I'll tell you, anybody that's worked in healthcare, experts, anybody, nobody, I don't know anybody, I haven't met or heard any, really logical arguments around increasing silos or separating care or disintegrating it. Nobody, I think one of the things that got lost a little bit, where I'll say, here's the, in really simple terms, prior to this decision of the four pillars, there was what happened in the community versus what happened in the acute care hospitals and facilities. They were quite they weren't connected the way they should be. So that the goal should be, if the government's coming in and the minister and the premier and the government's heard a lot of feedback saying, hey, there's gaps in how the community and the NHS are connected, that's absolutely what we should be trying to fix. How does the family physicians, the neurologists, the pediatricians, anybody working out in the community, how do they connect better with what happens in the acute care world? Same thing would be for anything you can think of, mental health. If you have mental health issues, you go into crisis, you have to come see me and Emerge and get admitted to the hospital for a bit. But then, of course, your illness doesn't stop when you get discharged from hospital. You need to get connected back to the community. So I'll say the ultimate driver of maybe what was going on around the decision of these four pillars was to actually integrate the community better with the hospital services. But something got missed. There was a misstep somewhere that the decision to make four separate pillars, but not actually tell us what those pillars are holding up, what connects them, how the patients are going to flow through them, how they're going to remain, this kind of not siloed and interconnected and actually seamless. That's the part that every time. So as the AMA president, one of the first things when I saw this, I said to the minister and the government, I said, like, we have to have somewhere you can have some input so we can tell you where there's going to be issues of the transition of the patient through these silos, or issues around, really simple examples in the acute care world. A big part of our problem in the hospital are alternative level of care patients that they need to go into long-term care or continuing care in the community. Well, now we have two pillars, one's continuing care and one's acute care. All the flow in acute care is impacted by what happens in the continuing care. Who's going to break that tension? Who's going to decide how they work together if they're two separate silos? That's a good example of where I'm scratching my head. All my colleagues are scratching their head. We're going to the table with the ADMs and the DMs and saying, listen, like, what you're thinking? What's your plan on this? So, yeah, I feel like I'm giving long answers to all your questions because healthcare is complex, right, man? Like, it's not easy. Just, yeah, I can give you a 1 second blur, but like, but to go back to answer your question, I haven't met anybody that thinks siloing and disintegrating so then they're not connected and seamless is a good idea. Everywhere across the world, everybody's trying to integrate more. Everybody's trying to connect more all these services. So ultimately, the strategy for the physicians and the healthcare workers and the experts is to try to talk to government and say, okay, if you're creating four pillars, what's going to connect them all at the top? How are they going to be integrated? How do we make it seamless for the patients? Because patients are going to get lost in all this if we're not careful. It's going to impact safe and timely care if we're not careful about it. So it's a huge concern for us.
Don't feel bad about the long answers. That's kind of our jam here. And sincerely, thank you. I mean, I'm going to ask the question this way. One of the things that has been made clear, it appears, is one of the goals with these new pillars appears to be, please correct me if I'm wrong, the removal of the arm's length influence of government on healthcare. This is something that Danielle Smith and several other ministers have cited as an advantage somehow. I haven't been able to wrap my head around that quite yet, but I'm not that bright, so do with that what you will. But their goal is to have government have a direct influence on healthcare. And I, it's going to be a long-winded question, so you can do a long
Okay.
answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, my immediate reaction to that is to kind of look of, okay, have we seen any examples of how government is going to influence healthcare? And certainly we see government breaking up or disintegrating the healthcare system, but we have also seen an announcement from Danielle Smith where she is literally being prescriptive over the type of medicine that can be practiced in the province of Alberta. And I find myself wondering, what's the reaction of the physician community to being told, hey, we're going to give you this great pay structure and it's going to be fantastic. And hey, we're going to damage all of the things that the Chandro did. But on occasion, without any evidence whatsoever, we might tell you how you can and can't practice medicine. Am I reading that wrong? Or is that like sort of a, oh, that's not great?
Oh, it's not good. So from the profession, it's definitely, I don't think Albertans think it's good, in the sense of, simplifying what your summary of your question was. If you ask many Albertans who should be deciding what's the best medicine to practice, you won't hear hardly any say it's the government. They're going to say, like, listen, like, I trained for 15 years to be an emergency physician, like, in counting undergraduate and going to med school, and in 5 years of residency in the hospital, working every day to make really tough decisions. Like, and so, who's better to make, decisions about your healthcare in collaboration with you? Is it you and your medical professionals that you trust that have trained that are experts in it? Or are you with government in between telling them what they can or cannot do? I don't think there's many Albertans that are in support of that. There are not my so across the board talking to my colleagues, they're extremely concerned about if that's the plan around government breaking up AHS so that they can be, practice medicine without a license. We're not in favor of that. No, and I don't think Albertans are. And so the other thing I'll say, maybe an even easier, quicker summary, is government, you have to be careful what you wish for. So if government is going to remove arm's length and be making a lot of operational decisions around how the system works, they also have nobody to blame. It's 100% of what happens in the healthcare system is going to be on the minister's desk and the government's desk now, because they're making operational decisions that really should be, typically the way it would work is they would set the policy, say, here's what we want, and then give it in an arm's length way to an organization that has accountability to them that will then deliver the top-notch services that they're hoping for, right? So yeah, I mean, it's two pieces to that big question you asked for, but I can tell you the profession is extremely concerned on a number of issues where the government is not taking our expert input and not incorporating it and are making decisions about people's health care, like and making decisions about what medical decisions can or not cannot be done in the province. Very, very concerned about that. And that's why we want to have continued dialogues on a number of these issues. And then to circle back to the breaking and restructuring and breaking up of AHS a little bit, there's different ways to get accountability. And I'm not sure breaking up AHS was necessarily exactly the solution that they had to get to. Like, as I can tell you, working in Medicine Hat, as an example, talking to my colleagues, yes, we would definitely like a bit more local control of being able to say within AHS functioning, hey, here's something that works really well in Medicine Hat. This is something different that works really well in Lethbridge. This is something different that works really well in Calgary. We should have input and be able to control and make that decision making. But you didn't have to break up AHS to do that. There was other ways we could have got that frontline input. So yeah. I'll just circle back again. The idea of government being prescriptive and practicing medicine without a license, I don't think there's many Albertans that are in favor of that.
And I think it's worth highlighting. I mean, obviously, the subject that I'm referencing is the questions around gender affirming care. And I think it is worth reference noting that the AMA, as well as multiple section chiefs within the AMA, have come out and said, "Oh, that's no good," and have released some fairly strong position statements saying that's no good. So, I mean, I want to be clear. I mean, I'm not trying to say in any way, oh, the provincial government is all bad. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about the funding piece first, because they did make the decision to put that stabilization funding in place. They are fingers crossed, in just a couple of days here, announcing the new funding model that will help bring some stability to family medicine. So there are some good things that this government has done, but I don't think that anyone is served by anybody being a cheerleader and not acknowledging that what you're doing, what parts of policy as well. Which kind of brings me to the last topic.
Can I jump in for
Yeah, absolutely.
one comment there? I want to, like, so the trans issue is a good example. The opioid treatment issue, maybe you're leading into that, I don't know, but those are examples of, here's part of what I think should resonate is that, listen, like, you should listen to the experts. So part of the thing I've been talking about for a long, saying long-winded answers, because healthcare is not, it's complex. It's not, you can't just say this, yes, no, boom, easy, done, you're good. It's complex. And so what we say, even as an AMA and as myself advocating very strongly, is listen to the experts. There's consensus opinion for a reason, because there's a sliding scale on certain things. There's certain things that are will evolve a little bit with time as medicine evolves, and there's nuances to medical care. And in the end, the ultimate best is the medical consensus of the experts, not a politician that is basically just doing it on, ideology and maybe not having any of the expert input. So that's how I would summarize those kind of pieces, is that I think most Albertans would say that ultimately you want this all to be guided by the medical experts and the consensus opinion within the expert community. And so when, as an example of the trans issue, when AMA's sections of pediatrics and sections of adolescent and pediatric psychiatry that deal with these patients every day, it wasn't just their opinion. They then, they supported the national opinion and the international consensus opinions. They're echoing what's the best opinion in medicine. And so I think as a society, we have to support that. So that I think it's really critical that people understand that that's the difference. Who's making your decisions? Is it the medical experts, or is it someone that was elected to be in government?
I love that you brought up the, I mean, yeah, you called where I was going to pivot to, but I love that you brought up the concept of consensus, because when you're talking about medicine, when you're talking about experts, there's always going to be that one guy who has, I don't know, maybe an extensive Twitter platform, who maybe doesn't actively practice medicine anymore because he's not allowed to, who, I'm just speculating, coming up with an imaginary figure. Maybe people often refer to him using Simpsons gifs. I don't know. But there's always going to be that one person who's just like, fuck's sake, would you stop? You're wrong. But they're still going to voice that opinion, and that opinion gets out into the ether. But it's the overwhelming majority of opinion of the actual experts who are allowed to practice medicine, that are the ones that should be listened to. So it's not like, I mean, there's a reason why 4 out of 5 dentists recommend, I don't know, something, because
Exactly.
there's always one.
There's one dentist in 100 that doesn't think brushing your teeth is a good idea. I mean, come on. So yes.
But you did bring up the you did set me up for the pivot for the last big subject, and then you just I had a thing I was going to do at the end, and I'm still going to do it at the end, but you kind of set me up for it. So we have seen some other prescriptive policies come forward, and I want to talk a little bit about the bubble that they exist in, which is, people call it the opioid crisis. And there's good reason for that, because when we take a look at the history of how the use of, or the expected use of, opioids kind of blossomed, there's no question that you have to have conversations about Purdue. There's no questions that you have to have conversations about OxyContin and bad marketing and all of those things. But when we take a look at what is responsible for deaths, and this is something that Daniel Smith and the provincial government did an excellent job of highlighting recently, where they talked about, hey, look at, we've got like next to no deaths in pharmaceutical opioids. That's true. So what's causing all of the deaths? It's not pharmaceutical opioids. It's all of the other things that exist in that sort of opioid bubble, which include a very toxic supply. So before I get to my bigger question, I want to ask, what are your thoughts on how an evidence-based approach would respond to the opioid crisis?
Yeah, well, so, this
Simple
is,
question.
I mean, you know what, honestly, I was just thinking I'll come on another time down the road and we could just do a whole talk on the opioid crisis. 'Cause I mean, it's real. Like it's every, I mean, even like in our jobs every day, we're seeing Albertans dying from this. Like it's a, and healthy young, like that, not to say that anybody dying is bad, but I'm just like, is really a lot of lost productive life years, like so such huge impact. It's a real thing. And so, the issue around, again, this is something I would even say. So I'm somewhat of an expert in it because I deal with it every day. And I would still be like, don't listen to me, listen to my addiction, specialist colleagues that are even more experts in it and deal with it every day. In the end, this is an hour-long conversation. But I'm going to tell you, my summary is, again, this is, there's a spectrum of a lot of treatments. And on that spectrum, there's never ever one, almost nothing you do, like even cancer care or infections, different things. There's a spectrum again, and you can never say, hey, we can only ever treat everything on this side of the spectrum. We can only do this and cut out a whole bunch of the other pieces of the spectrum. And that's the case with opioid poisonings and the opioid crisis we're seeing now too, is that evidence-based approach shows that a couple things, that there's, that you got to meet the patients where they're at in the spectrum. You've got to actually treat them in ways that are going to be effective for the patient. So it has to be, really where they are in their situation and what's going to be most effective for them. And it's going to be a sliding scale and process. And so the evidence shows that you can't just cut out a whole whack of that spectrum. You've got to kind of meet the patients where they're at and really look at it as a new and nuanced kind of sliding scale that'll change over time. That'd be a nutshell of an answer. And there's a really good, evidence around there that no one approach works for every single person in anything in medicine, and it's ever true with opioid crisis and opioid poisonings right now too.
I'm going to take you up on that offer to have a much longer conversation somewhere down the road on the opioid crisis. And I will ask you only two more questions on the opioid stuff. Is there a toxic supply that is contributing to the death of Albertans, in your opinion?
1,000,000%, like no question. So, and that toxic supplies, again, this is why it's really important. If you think about the history of what's happened with opioids and the opioid crisis, what there was a pivoting and a change, and really, kind of dumbing it down really simply, they can cook fentanyl. They can make it with products. You don't have to go get a poppy plant from and smuggle opium over. They can cook it in Alberta. They can cook it anywhere. They can manufacture it. The fentanyl supply that's manufactured out there now, again, simplifying, it's some like, it could be a high school dropout that's making this, and the concentration and power of that fentanyl, it's so powerful, and nobody knows necessarily what's, when they're buying it off the street, how much they're getting, what's the amount they're getting, like, and it is killing people. Like people that are opioid naive and don't know what they're taking, they think they're getting something else, and they end up getting an opioid because there's so much of it that it's so prevalent that it's sold as other things, so you never know what you're getting. But there's even people that have been using opioids for a long time safely, managing their addiction and their disease, that are overdosing with it because there is a toxic supply of illicit fentanyl out there that's killing people. And there's carfentanil, and there's variations, and there are some adulterants in there that we're seeing that are like literally like elephant tranquilizer kind of meds that get added to it that are just lethal. And yes, yes, 1,000%, there's a toxic supply of fentanyl there. And people don't know, there's lots and lots of, unfortunately, people, like I said, that don't know what they're even getting when they get street drugs or that are just get into trouble because of that toxic supply.
Yeah, I remember. And I mean, the reason why I asked the question, this is one of the great frustrations for me. And again, disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer. I was flabbergasted when I first started seeing patients coming back with low blood sugars. And it was because of a harm reduction group that I encountered that were like, well, they're cutting it with metformin. And I went, metformin, for anybody who's not familiar, is a diabetes drug that can lower your blood sugar in very bad ways. And I was blown away that there are people who are using, they believe that they're buying fentanyl or some form of an opiate, and they're also getting metformin, which is precipitously lowering their blood sugar. And unless you think to check, why are they not awake yet? You're never going to see that sort of thing. And that to me is illustrative of the toxic supply. But the other question that I wanted to ask you on the opioid piece, is, as a physician, one of the responsibilities that you carry is exercised by way of something called a form. I'm going to use a form one as example. And I'll ask you to explain to the audience what the form one is, because I don't get to do that. So you'll be able to explain much better. But before I get to the big question, can you explain to our audience what a form one is?
Yep. So if someone is, in my expert opinion or healthcare expert opinion, a risk for themselves or others, then we have a legal device that's called a Form One that allows us to, in our judgment, restrain that patient and keep them against their will for a minimum of 24 hours to A, allow the situation to settle if that's appropriate, B, allow us to then seek further, like a psychiatric evaluation or other opinions if we need to keep them longer. And then we can do other forms and other things. But the form one allows us to restrain the patient for 24 hours. And when I say restrain, it's important that people understand what that means. Like, can keep them against their will in the emergency department, and we can use physical restraint. So sometimes we do to protect people so they don't hurt themselves, have to actually tie them down sometimes. And the other is chemical restraint, meaning some sedation, some medicines so that we can restrain them. But the most important why I'm being so specific in this is that it doesn't give us the right to treat them. It doesn't give us the right to actually force treatments on them or do anything. It allows us to restrain them and keep them so that we can protect themselves and protect others. And when I say protect others, I mean, there are some people that are homicidal, of course, but there are lots of people that are just not, they're psychotic or delusional, or they're a harm to them, they're a risk to their loved ones, but also healthcare workers. I mean, EMS get assaulted all the time, nurses, physician, emergency physicians, we see it all the time. So that form one allows us to keep them and then formulate a plan and then usually allow some interventions around when they're cooperative, but it doesn't allow us to force treatment on them as it exists right now. So that's I hope that's a summary that helps.
It does, and it obviously tees me up for my next question. As a physician who has the ability to, when appropriate, leverage things like physical restraints, chemical restraints, et cetera, when a person is believed to be a threat to themselves or to others, what is your reaction to the impending legislation on forced treatment for people who are experiencing repeated overdoses, whether or not those overdoses are a result of a toxic supply or something else? Who knows? What's your reaction to somebody being able to say, you know what, I'm going to take away your charter rights on a long-term basis so that I can make you better?
So, at risk of maybe getting myself into trouble, I'll say that in Alberta we do not have forced treatment for anything. So even if you took someone that has a severe mental illness and schizophrenia and they're delusional and hear voices, and we can keep them in hospital, we can't force treatment upon them. We can't force medications on them. There are some very narrow areas where legally they can agree to some depot shots and things like that, but we cannot force treatment on anyone. And I just want to be, Albertans need to understand and be very careful that The idea of forced treatment is something that has happened in the past, like things like lobotomies, things like lots of things. You know, there used to be forced treatments and forced sterilization. There's a lot of history and legacy around forcing treatment on human beings that have always been pretty negative, and in hindsight, looks back that it's very dangerous territory. So, at risk of getting myself in trouble, but I'll express my own opinion is that this is very, very problematic and extremely dangerous territory for government to be wading into and not listening to the medical and expert opinion and weighing into an area that that's already been historically really fraught with very bad consequences and outcomes. As a medical profession, I mean, I'm giving most of my opinion right now, but talking to my colleagues, and that there is massive concern about ideas around, you know, forced compassionate. Compassionate is a bit of a euphemism there, because that, you know, forced treatment on people is, and the other part I would just say, thinking about it too, just to be clear, like, addictions is, it's a very, you know, it's a very complicated thing. It's not just a turn on off. There's mental illness components to it or not, but there's situational components, and we just know. I mean, look at the long history of alcoholism as an example. Forcing people to try to quit is never worked. It's a, you know, it's when the patients are ready to get help, and it's a lifelong journey. It's not just a boom, you're done. So yeah, there's a lot of concerns in there. Like I said, this could be a whole other hour-long talk, all of this stuff. So, but it's concerning, and people should be concerned about it, and people should be very thoughtful about it, because the history and the legacy of forced treatment is not positive.
I got one last question for you, because I know we've gone over the time that you committed to. I do that. But you referenced it earlier, the announcement that you made with the Premier of Alberta and with the Minister of Health in regards to that stabilization payment. And there were a lot of people that were unquestionably excited about the stabilization payment. I imagine there were a lot of family physicians who went, "Oh, thank God." But that wasn't the lightning strike moment of that press conference. And I think that the reason why I want to spend a little bit of time on this, if we can, is I think that the reaction to the your answer on vaccines was so profound for so many people, because there is that desire for, please just tell us the truth. Please just tell us the evidence-based truth. And we have seen that this unnecessary conversation around vaccination can continues to persist. So I was wondering if you might be willing to do one of your greatest hits, because as long as there are people out there that are maybe best represented by Simpsons memes, who are spreading lies about the vaccines and vaccinations and all of those things, I think that it's incumbent on the rest of us to go, "Oh, that's bullshit. Here's what the actual facts are. You did it once before. I know that we are seeing a certain degree of vaccine fatigue. I know that we're seeing vaccination rates dropping off somewhat because the sense of crisis has to some degree abated. Give me as much time as you want on vaccines, Dr. Parks."
Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't actually think this was coming, but I got to tell you again. I'll reiterate. Like, I'm unapologetic. I'm a scientist. I'm a physician. I vaccines work. There's not a debate. Like, there's this false idea that there's a debate about vaccinations. They work. So, you know, again, this is that kind of example. 99 out of 100 docs say, you know, vaccinations work, and one out of 100 says doesn't. It's like the dentist and the brush and the teeth, man. Like, but it's what's more scary, and why I don't mind talking about this again, is, listen, like, we're in a world where we're seeing measles again. Like, it's insane. So just, I was on shift again on Monday. I actually had to get a blood test. This is not like for me. I got a blood test because there's enough worry about measles outbreaks right now that as healthcare workers, if we get exposed to measles and we are not got proper vaccination slash our titers up enough, we are out of work. I personally, as an emerge doc, can't work for 6 weeks because I could possibly have measles and have it be totally subclinical, and I could give it to immunocompromised and sick people. Can you imagine a world where we're already talking about healthcare workers are so depleted that if our healthcare workers didn't have measles vaccinations and they got exposed, they'd be out of work for 6 weeks, not knowing whether or not they even got exposed or had measles. That's the kind of world we're living in right now that it baffles my mind, Nate. Like, it's truly, honestly, something got broken there and something got disconnected, and we have to break that narrative. I've seen children die of preventable vaccination preventable illnesses, and getting something like measles. If you're a parent, do you want to take a risk that you're no one in a thousand, your child might get brain damage from it or might die? Like, it's just a bizarre world to me. And so we have to break this narrative. Vaccinations work. And some of these terrible, terrible diseases that we've been blessed to not see a lot of over the last kind of call it 40, 50 years is because of vaccinations and because of the way that the medical science and our kind of evolution and understanding and the ability to make really targeted vaccines and a whole bunch of things have improved. So yeah, they work. Get your vaccinations. And they this there's also this other thing that's been lost a bit of that vaccinations will protect you and I when we get them ourselves, but then it protects our grandparents and our little baby children and all the people around us. So yeah, I feel pretty strongly and passionate about it. The last thing I'd just say too that baffles me a little bit is that people will come in to emerge and kind of demand an antibiotic from me from something that is a respiratory infection that I know is almost certainly viral from my clinical expertise, and the antibiotic won't help. And they don't actually have an understanding that the risks of antibiotics, they're amazing. They're a miraculous drug when you need them, but they have lots of risks. The risks of taking an antibiotic for 7 days is way higher than the risks of getting any vaccination, like by a long shot in many, many different cases. But that's not, that's not something people talk about or weigh or think. They're just like, give me my antibiotic. I want my miracle cure. I want this now and I want to be cured. But I don't want to do the miracle thing that will prevent me from getting sick in the first place. So we just have to break that narrative. And again, listen to the experts, listen to the evidence. This is critical. We're heading down some tough times if we don't change course on this.
Yeah, it's stunning to me that we live in a world where we are fortunate enough, blessed, whatever adjective you want to use, where we have experts and very smart people who spend their entire lives specializing in, one particular thing, and they are able to produce, as you said, these miracles of science that protect us. And it blows my mind how no, I want to listen to the guy who lost his medical license. That's who I want to side with. It just that defies me. But I'm definitely going to be following up with you in a little while, sir, about a longer conversation about the opioid crisis and the toxic supply, because it is complex and it is nuanced, and there's so much mis and disinformation that exists out there. So I'm going to definitely take you up on that offer, but you've been
Let's do
very
it.
generous with your time tonight. So I want to let you go before I completely exhaust you. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat and cover some of these really complex issues and simplify them for our audience so that some of these things hopefully will make a bit more sense.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, like I said, in the end, that is, medicine is complex, right? So the healthcare system's complex. And so anytime I'm happy to chat about this. I think part of the thing that's lost is having some discussions about these kind of things and hearing from, like what, honestly, I'll go back to the vaccines. When I talk to my colleagues out there, there's just not debate about The measles vaccine is amazing. It's super safe. Like, there's not a debate. Like, a lot of these things that are false out there, there's a lot of science and a lot of consensus and very strong positivity there. So having discussions about it, and around the opioid crisis as an example, it's real. Like, there's real, badness out there in Alberta and across Canada because of the toxic drugs that's out there, and we should discuss it more, and we should be frank. And the last part I'll say is thanks for your time, and just say one of the things, is that medicine always evolves. Like, it's never ever exactly got it 100% perfect. We kind of do this whole evidence-based medicine that we evolve and go, sometimes there's mistakes made, or sometimes we're a little bit on the wrong side, but most part, like, we really are on the right side in our consensus, and then we slowly evolve. And the good examples, vaccines, like what the vaccines looked like 100 years ago versus the vaccines we have now for the same diseases that we developed, they're infinitely better. They're not mixed in horse serum. They're not, like, there's a whole bunch of things that we've gotten better at. So I just say having these dialogues and discussions are important, and so I appreciate the opportunity to be able to just kind of be kind of frank and blunt and honest about some of these things. So,
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, sir.
yep, awesome.
And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, we would love nothing more than if you thought about signing up to be one of our Patreon sponsors at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab, where for just the price of a fancy cup of coffee a month, you can help us continue to produce this kind of content. Whether you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, in which case, maybe leave a review and a rating, or whether you're watching it on one of our streaming platforms, we want to say a big thank you to everybody who is part of The Breakdown's audience. And as always, take care of each other and keep the conversation going.